Okay. What I'd like to do briefly this evening, in half an hour, is talk a little bit about how I see non-duality, from that moving into the nature of consciousness, and more about the mystical experience, and then look at how psychedelics relate to that. So, starting with non-duality. As Stephen said, the word is a direct translation of the Hindu Advaita, which means literally, the vita is two, at means not two. But it doesn't mean one. If they meant one, they'd have said one. They very carefully point out it's not two. And there's a subtle difference, which is really important, because people think non-duality is saying everything is one and the duality is an illusion. But it isn't saying that. It's saying the duality is very real and there is a oneness as well. It's not just two. It's not just duality. And an analogy that's used, it goes way back to the Upanishads, about 2,500 years ago. One of the teachers is teaching his students this, and he's saying, you have here two pots, two clay pots. They are clearly very different, distinct clay pots. However, they are both made of clay. Their essence is the same. It's the same clay, the same essence. So there is duality in that there are two pots. That is real. And there is a oneness that is also real. So I see non-duality as both. It's the reality of a common essence to everything, and that is not in conflict with the reality of duality, which in this sense could be this reality here we're experiencing right now is full of form, duality, so much of the material, what we call the material world, I'll get into that more in a moment, and it is all of the same essence. And you could say what science has tried to do, in a way you could say modern scientific worldview is a Advaita worldview, except it sees the essence that it is looking for as something to do with matter, energy, space and time. And yet, as science has looked into what is the essence of the material world, it finds nothing. It gets closer and closer to nothing. There seems to be actually nothing there. I'm sure you've heard this, that an atom is 99.9999999% empty space. If the nucleus of an atom was the size of a pea in the centre of this room, the electrons would be like specks of dust flying around the outside of the room. The rest of it is empty space. But that was 100 years ago. Then along came quantum physics, and it revealed that that speck of dust, well, that pea in the middle and the specks of dust, weren't actually things at all. They weren't actually particles. They're just the probabilities of finding something, maybe having certain characteristics, maybe or maybe not. It's like there's actually nothing there. But when you put it all together, it appears as something. But that's the scientific worldview. Then there's our own consciousness. And this is what Advaita is really referring to, is not the material world as such. I think it's often mistaken when it's saying that, you know, the material world is all of the same essence of consciousness. What these teachers were pointing to is that everything we know, all our experience, all of it, is but an appearance in consciousness. That's all we ever know. Anything, our theories, our experience, our thoughts, are all just appearances in consciousness. And this was, I mean, Immanuel Kant was the philosopher who really saw this 200 years ago when he said, we never know the thing in itself. We never know the world out there directly. All we know is the experience that arises in our mind. That's all we ever can know. And what this means, fascinating, is that everything we know is actually made of consciousness. Now, you say that to an average materialistic scientist, that it's like, you know, a mind deranged by too much meditation or psychedelics or something. But actually, this is something which the Western scientific worldview cannot argue against. I mean, if we take our thoughts, if we just consider a thought for the moment, you know, we're always having thoughts. What are thoughts made of? I mean, on one level, they're made of, you know, a voice inside your head, or words, or ideas, or pictures. But what are they actually made of? What's the stuff of them? And it's clearly not matter stuff. Your thought is not made of quarks or electrons or whatever matter is supposedly made of. The only thing we can call it, the best we have in English, is mind stuff. They're made of whatever the mind is made of. Thoughts are made of mind stuff. In Hinduism, Sanskrit, it's the word chitta. Chit means consciousness, and chitta means of consciousness. Thoughts are composed of consciousness. They're an activity in consciousness. And that much is obvious. A thought is an activity of consciousness. Then you step back a bit and say, well, what about your experience of the body? You close your eyes. You notice various sensations. These also are just an activity appearing in consciousness. And then you could say, sound. If you hear music in your mind, if you imagine music, what is that music made of? It's made of chitta. It's actually another activity of consciousness. It's just consciousness arising in the form of music. If you're actually listening to music where the stimulus is coming from the outside world, it's no different. The sound waves are impacting the air, and the brain is very cleverly putting together its image of what is out there, and you have this experience of music. But again, the experience is composed of chitta, of consciousness. And we can all begin to relate to that. Where it gets tricky is when we open the eyes. And we have to accept that the same is true of this visual, spatial world we appear to live within. The same thing is happening. But now, because vision is so strongly spatial, we are seduced into believing we're seeing the world directly. But what we're actually experiencing is another arising in consciousness, that this is all that we're experiencing. The actual experience itself, I'm not talking about whatever there is that may or may not be out there, the actual experience itself is another form arising in chitta, arising in consciousness. And this is really hard to see because we get sucked into this spatial world. And I think one of the things that really confuses people in this realm is we get caught up in thinking, the world I see is somehow the real world. But it isn't. And this is what Kant was saying. We never know what the real world is. And so this is almost the most mind-blowing bit, is to realize that this spatial world I see, this visual spatial world, is composed of chitta, of consciousness. But that's one thing that psychedelics can sometimes reveal, is you begin to see that creation of this visual spatial world can begin to dissolve, and you begin to see through it, or see somehow how it's being created, or to see the different fields in it. I think it was Stan Grof who said, one of the very early LSD experimenters, who said, once anybody's had a psychedelic experience, they can never again believe in the reality of the world they experience, the outside world. They can never again take it quite as seriously. They've begun to reveal that everything isn't quite as it seems. So, what the mystical experience is really about, I think, is being able to step back from the appearance that is occurring in citta, the appearance that is occurring in consciousness, and to recognize the other reality, which is the reality of that which is knowing the experience. We call it the I, the self, the knower, that quality of being that's always there. And it's that sense of I-ness that's ever present. And it's a common query in many spiritual traditions, the query, the investigation, who am I? You know, when you ask ordinary people at that level, who am I? The first response usually is, well, I am Peter Russell. And you say, go on, you know, I am male. You go on and you can come up with, you know, no end of things in your job, your whatever that is, your interests, your beliefs. These are all aspects of our identity which we derive from our experience of the world. That's not what the mystical traditions are asking when they say, explore that question, who am I? They're not asking for you to define yourself in psychosocial terms. They're really asking, what does the word I actually refer to? What does the word I actually refer to? And when you delve into that, you find this sort of paradoxical thing that it's something which, on the one hand, is so familiar. We all know what we mean by I. It's that sense of meanness being which has been there all our life. It's that same I that was experiencing coming here, experiencing yesterday, experiencing whatever you were experiencing 20 years ago. When you were a kid, it never, ever changes. It's always that same quality of I here experiencing this, I here experiencing that. It's always the same. And yet, you cannot put it in words. There are no words to it, which is why again and again the mystical experience is described as ineffable. It cannot be put in words. It's beyond words. Because if you could put it in words, you'd actually be making it another thing that could be experienced, another object of experience. And that would be something else that I am experiencing. So it's almost inevitable. It cannot be put in words. And yet it is so, so familiar. And yet, most of the time, we are not aware of it. And that's because our attention is directed outward, I say outward, onto this world of experience that is arising in consciousness. We're not always outward onto the world of experience. It may be onto all the thoughts and things that are going through the mind. We get sucked into our thoughts. They become really important, mainly because most of our thoughts are there to help us get through life in one way or another, and they seem really important. So our attention is on the thoughts, or our attention is on what we're doing or what's happening or something else, or maybe having some wonderful, far-out experience. And we don't notice that which is attending. You can say that there's two ends of attention, the attention. There's what we are attending to, and there's what is attending, the I that is attending. And that's what the Advaita traditions and the other non-dual traditions are about, is turning the attention around to begin to recognize that quality of I that is attending, that very familiar, but you cannot put it in words, quality. In Indian thought, it's often labeled Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat means it never changes. It's always the same. Chit means it is consciousness. What we call I is just the name we give to being conscious. It's the name we give to being conscious. So it is Chit. And then it is Ananda, which is one of these words that's got really mistranslated. I mean, you've all heard, I'm sure most of you heard the word Ananda. It's generally translated as bliss, which is, in a way, a misdirection. And what happened was, a couple of hundred years ago, earnest academics went out to the East, and there were these new religions and new languages and new cultures, and they were looking to how to translate these words, and somehow the word bliss stuck as the translation of Ananda. But if you go back and look at the Sanskrit, the R in the front of it means extra, deep. Nanda means contentment, contentment. So it just means deep contentment. Not so much an exotic, out there, ecstatic, take me out of the world bliss, but just a deep, deep contentment. And this is what I think is the natural state of mind. And natural mind, when we're not worried, we're not anxious, we're not perturbed by things, is one of deep contentment. But what we do in our culture is we take ourselves out into our experience, and we get lost in our experience, and we start creating discontent. Oh, I haven't got this, I need this, this isn't right, whatever. We start creating discontent and then start seeking how can we ease this discontent by doing something, getting something, buying something, having new experiences, whatever it is, all the time looking to find contentment through what we have or do, not realizing that very often the reason we're not feeling contentment is the very fact we're seeking something out there. I think this is sometimes the sad joke about human beings, is we're so busy worrying about whether or not we're going to be at peace in the future, we never give ourselves the chance to be at peace right now. Because by definition, a mind that is worrying cannot be a mind that is at peace. And this is what, again, I think all the traditions have been pointing to, that we're looking for something in the wrong direction. We're looking for happiness, peace, contentment, whatever you want to call it. We even use different words. We're looking out there for something that's already here, but we're missing it. There's that lovely Nasruddin story, I'm sure a lot of you know. Nasruddin is the wise fool in Sufi tales. And one day he's outside his house underneath the street lamp, scrabbling around on the earth, looking for something, and his neighbor comes and says, "You know, have you lost something? Can I help you?" He says, "Yes, I've lost my key, lost the key to the house." He says, "Oh, you know, let me help you." And he gets down, scrabbling around in the dirt, looking for it, and they can't find it. And after a while, he says, "Well, you know, where exactly did you drop it?" And he said, "Somewhere inside my house." And he says, "Well, excuse me, why are you looking for it out here?" He says, "Well, there's more light out here." Now, you know, it seems, we laugh, seems silly. But there's a wisdom in his teachings. And that is what we do in our culture. We're almost hypnotized from birth onwards. If we're not happy, do something. Look out there in the material world, because that's the key to happiness. The key we've lost is an inner key. It's the key of how do we allow the mind to settle down, and in that settling down, come back and rediscover our true nature, rediscover the essence of consciousness. And that involves, in one way or another, stepping back from our experience. Just want to see how I'm doing for time. I should be moving on. There's lots more to say. So let me just I do want to say, just bring in something else, going back to what I was saying earlier, just because it's relevant to all of this, in terms of the Advaita. I'm saying how everything we experience is ultimately consciousness. I think we can actually say, we have to say, that the same is true of whatever the world out there is ultimately composed of. Whatever it is ultimately composed of, that the no-thingness that science is discovering has to actually be a field that has the potential for experience, that has the potential for consciousness. Because if there is consciousness, because we are conscious, it's the only thing we know for sure is that we are conscious. I mean, right now we could all be sitting in the matrix. But if we were all sitting in the matrix, we would still be experiencing. So the one thing we can say for sure is that we are conscious, and that every other being is conscious. And if you track it all the way down, you have to come to the conclusion that consciousness is an essential characteristic of the cosmos, not just in terms of the foundation of everything we know, but also of the cosmos out there. So what is happening when we reconnect with the source of our experience, we reconnect with the I, that pure consciousness, we are reconnecting with not just our own essence, but we are reconnecting with the essence of the cosmos. And Stephen alluded to this. That's where I think the idea of God comes in. In, again, going back to Hindu teachings, they say Atman is Brahman. The essence of I is the source of everything in the cosmos. That my innermost essence has to be the essence of everything it is. So in reconnecting with our own essence, we are reconnecting with the cosmos. Of course, you translate that into English and you get I am God, which can get you into deep trouble. It used to get you burnt at the stake. As Ram Dass likes to point out, his brother was actually in a mental institution for a while, and his brother said to him, "You go around saying, I am God, and everybody flocks to your lectures and buys your books." He said, "I say I am God, and they lock me up. What's the difference?" He said, "Ah, but you say you are God and no one else. I say we are all God, we are all divine." And that is another aspect, again, Stephen was pointing towards that, of this essential mystical experience. So how do psychedelics relate to this? As I already mentioned, they can lead to that dissolving of the appearance of the world. But more importantly, what I'm really interested in is how they can facilitate that deep, essential mystical experience of reconnection with the knower, with that pure being, that pure self. And that often requires, I think, an intention to be moving in that direction, because many altered states of consciousness, because they can be so exotic, let's just say exotic, there is the temptation to become absorbed in whatever it is, the exoticness of the experience and how different it is or far out it is or whatever, or the information one is getting about whatever, which can just be another great seduction, a wonderful seduction, but it can be another great seduction into the world of experience. But the other side is, can they also allow the deconstruction of experience in such a way that you begin to recognize that which is always present, to recognize the I that is always there, that sense of being, however you want to formulate it? Can they allow you to come back to that? Because that, for me, is the true mystical experience. And they can be teachers for that. They can actually be ways to show you ways to actually let go and come back to that, basically to come back to one's own essence. And so what I like to suggest to people as things to keep in mind. One is, wherever one is in one's journey, is there an easier way of being with that experience? Is there an easier way of being with it? Because when the mind gets caught up and becomes tense in any way or overexcited, we're not going to be opening up to the stillness. So is there an easier way of being with that? And a second one is, whatever the experience, is just to pause and notice, or even ask the question, who is experiencing this? Am I not the one who is experiencing this right now? To come back to noticing that sense of I-ness, which is always present, it's always there. You can be having the most far-out experience, but it's still I that is experiencing it. Come back and notice that. And lastly, to, in a way, favor the silence, favor the stillness, favor the spaciousness, rather than the exoticness. To have it as a way of really coming back and reconnecting with the essence. And in that way, I think they can be a tool for realizing what all the great Advaita teachers, Dzogchen teachers in Buddhism, Taoists, have been pointing towards. Almost every mystical tradition in the world, that's what they've been pointing towards. So let me leave it there, and we're going to have time for questions and discussion later. Thank you.